Ladies and gentlemen, please stand by. Your conference is about to begin. Welcome to this information session hosted by Great Lakes United. At this time, all lines are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, you will be asked to press star one on your touch-tone phone. As a reminder, this session is being recorded Tuesday, January 10th, 2012. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. John Jackson, Director of Clean Production and Toxics with Great Lakes United. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. We're really pleased to welcome all of you to this session that we're doing today on the health implications of fracking for natural gas in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River Basin. We've been quite overwhelmed by the immediacy of response from people throughout the basin and far beyond the Great Lakes Basin in terms of wanting to be on this session and to hear about it. We actually reached our limit of 200 people that we're able to do through this system, and that was just really quite amazing. So it's clearly an issue that people are very concerned about, and a lot of people are working on, because in addition to getting registrations, and I want to thank Lauren Cheadle for doing that as staff person at Great Lakes United. She's really spent a lot of time pulling that together. In addition to that, we've had a lot of emails from people talking about the stuff that they're doing on fracking and some of the issues that they're concerned about. In this period, we won't be able to go in great detail on everything, but we do want to give you a good overview and in terms of the issues, and it's really the beginning of a discussion that we hope will stimulate people further. The format that we'll be using today is one of hearing from all three of our presenters first, and then we'll be opening it up for comments, discussion, questions. And at that point, we'll be going back to the phone operator, Chris, who you'll be contacting, and he'll remind you of how to do that at that point. If we're not going to be going into sort of technical detail, you're looking at slide two of hydrofracking on this call. What our focus is going to be on instead is what are the health implications, and that's why we're so pleased to have Dr. Theo Colburn with us, who's a leading expert on health issues, to talk with us about this. The other thing, if you look at slide three, why this is such an important issue for the Great Lakes. The map that I have there is something that was put together by the Canadian Energy Research Institute, and this is the industry. This is the gas and oil industry, and the areas that they have there are areas that they consider as their prime areas where they hope to really develop this industry, are already working on developing it, but the prime areas that they see that they'll be able to get it. And if you look at the Great Lakes area, we are clearly one of the prime areas where they're seeing the potential and are already working. So I'd like to turn it over now to Theo, and if you want to, I'll ask each speaker to do a quick introduction of themselves before they get into their presentation. So Theo?
Well, gosh, John, I didn't expect to do that. My name is Theo Colburn. I am a professor emeritus at the University of Florida, Gainesville, and also have an honorary doctorate of science from the University of Colorado. I am also president of TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, that I started here in Paonia, Colorado in 2002 when I found out that my back was not going to let me work in Washington, D.C. Before that, of course, I was operating the Wildlife and Contaminants Program at World Wildlife Fund, and from the very beginning, my work started with the International Joint Commission, and all of my activity has grown out of what we learned about what's going on in the Great Lakes. So I accepted this opportunity from John to speak today in order to bring you another perspective that has been sadly neglected and sort of swept under the rug. Most of you probably do not remember Paul Harvey, you're too young, I bet, who many years ago had a talk radio news program. He called it The Rest of the Story. Well, that is what I want to do today. Tell the rest of the story of what it is like to work and live where natural gas industrialization is taking place. We will look. I hope you have the first slide up, John.
Everybody's turning them themselves, so when you want to go to the next slide, you just tell people that they're doing it.
We will look at a major problem that has made it impossible to adequately regulate the natural gas industry and protect public health. The problem is being that the complete lack of air pollution monitoring. And to do this, I'm going to focus on exposure, those who are being exposed, and what the difficulty of providing proof of exposure means to those who work and live where natural gas activity takes place. Click. So setting water pollution aside, what follows focuses on the invisible and oftentimes odorless chemicals that people suspect have made them ill long before their drinking water could become contaminated. We will look at four examples of sources for airborne chemicals that could be causing overt and covert health problems for those who work and live in gas patches. Click. We'll talk about volatile chemicals introduced deliberately. We'll look at exhaust from mobile and stationary equipment. We'll look at hydrogen sulfide under certain conditions and fugitive gas other than methane from underground that I call the sleeper. Click. At TEDx, we spent years putting together a list of products that are used during drilling and fracking to get natural gas out of the ground. This list is available on our website. As we compiled the list of products, we also listed the chemicals that the companies revealed were in their products. There are 980 products on the list. Of these, 421, or 43%, provided less than 1% information about what is in them, and only 14% gave the full formulation. Now, we were able to find the names of 649 chemicals in those products, but only 362 had a specific chemical name, and out of those 362 identifiable chemicals, 36% are volatile, many of which have adverse health effects. Click. These chemicals are deliberately added to the fluids. These chemicals are deliberately added to the fluids used to facilitate the release of the natural gas from the ground. Here you see the health profiles of the volatile chemicals plotted against the water-soluble chemicals, and it shows the frequency of the chemicals having possible health effects. As you can see, the volatile chemicals were more toxic than the water-soluble. For example, starting on the left, 95% of the chemicals cause eye, nose, and skin irritation, often the first effect workers and residents complain about, as well as sensory organ irritation, a scratchy throat, ringing of ears, rashes, chronic sinus problems, and often headaches. Then moving to the right, we move into the respiratory symptoms, asthma, sinus problems, and flu-like complaints. Then next, go to the right to gastrointestinal problems because so many chemicals make people feel nauseous. And then there is the brain and central and peripheral nervous systems that show up next for 85% of the chemicals. Then kidney, cardiovascular, and blood. And note that cancer drops down to 30%. But then endocrine disruption, which includes reproductive and developmental effects, bounces back up to 50%. Abnormal bone development or outright death are most often associated with the other column. And, of course, ecological effects that include wildlife, where in some instances certain chemicals at the invertebrate level are very sensitive at the very low end of our food web. Click. These man-made VOCs used for fracking or drilling could escape during the chemical mixing process for both the drilling and fracking fluids, during injection while drilling and fracking, and then during flowback when the fracking fluids start coming back up to the surface, and especially while the recovered fluids are stored in open reserve pits on the pad or until the fluids are totally disposed of. Click. The second source of chemicals is the VOCs from combustion of diesel and other fuels to maintain mobile and stationary equipment during operations. They are in the exhaust stream that is released in large volumes, 24/7, throughout both drilling and fracking operations. Many of the wells drilled in Colorado within the past decade took as much as a month to complete. Today, using new sophisticated rigs and diamond drill bits, but don't expect to have these in your neighborhood, a drill event may still take as long as a week or more. To back this equipment up, there will be many huge tanker trucks and coming and going to the pad, carrying a constant supply of both diesel fuel and water. Click. They sit in long lines, idling their motors, waiting their turn to unload. In addition, many auxiliary service pickup trucks move in and out of the pad throughout the day and night. To their exhaust is added the exhaust from huge generators and compressors that burn diesel to maintain pressure throughout all the operations. Click. And added to all that is the flaring or burning off of the natural gas that begins to escape from the ground the minute the drill bore hits gas in the target stratum. Look to the lower right bottom of the picture. That is a pad where drilling and fracking is finished.
This is slide number 13 for people just in case they got behind. Sorry, Theo, go ahead.
It's my number 10. Okay, number 13?
Oh, it's number 13 on theirs.
Okay. Let me see. And they are apparently waiting to hook up to the local delivery. Well, okay, that pad is finished. Now they're apparently waiting to hook up to the local delivery line and bring the well to completion. But all during that time, they let the gas escape by flaring. And you can see that over in the right-hand corner. Flaring may go on for months. We have a well near us that has been waiting for a year that has been flaring. The flaring exacerbates exposure by contributing fine particulate matter to the air that for many individuals causes irritation and respiratory problems. And I know one man who has convulsions if he gets downwind from a flare. Click. And yet another overlooked source of exposure is hydrogen sulfide in areas where there are sulfides in the soil and where chemicals in open pits can react and produce it. Hydrogen sulfide has a rotten egg smell, but it is harmful long before you can smell it. It has been a bane to welders on oil and gas pads for years. Most of them now wear wrist monitors to detect it. But the most overlooked chemicals the workforce and neighbors will come in contact with are the native VOCs that come to the surface in the natural gas along with the methane. Methane, the largest volatile component in natural gas at about 85% or more, is not toxic. But many of the other gases that escape from the ground with the methane come with their own set of health problems. They can escape at every juncture, from equipment on the pad, like the Christmas trees where the gas comes up from the ground, especially from heater treaters, where gases and oils are separated from the fluids that come up with the gas, and at every other piece of stationary equipment, like compressors, and then pigging stations all along the pipelines. Click. Despite all of the above, neither the federal government nor industry is doing much monitoring of the air environment around natural gas activity. The good news is that some citizens have managed to get the money to take some infrared pictures that reveal the fugitive gases leaking from all kinds of stationary equipment on and off the pad. And better yet, local citizens have started what is called the Bucket Brigade, in which they do their own sampling. And even some counties are doing some cross-sectional sampling. Click, can you still hear me?
Yes, we're just fine, Theo.
I heard a click there for a minute, and I thought maybe we went off.
No.
Okay. No. Okay. So here we provide just a partial list of the health effects of those chemicals that have 11 health effects out of a possible 12. A large percent interfere with the brain and the endocrine system, which operates at extremely low concentrations. You know from the work around the Great Lakes, endocrine disrupting chemicals can have devastating impacts on wildlife and humans. For most of these chemicals, there are no government safety standards to identify at what level exposure leads to harm. And for those where a safety standard may have been established, the standard was based on an 8-hour workday, 5 days a week for a 70-kilogram man working in a confined area. None of those standards took into consideration effects on the endocrine system and the consequences of prenatal exposure. Click. So let's take a look at the jobs that are going to be available for people who like to work outside. Other than a handful of salaried managers working directly for the large corporations, the bulk of the labor force needed to get the gas into commerce works on contracts, subcontracts, and sub-subcontracts. We have even run into a situation where someone was hired through a temp agency as a sub-sub-subcontractor and without proper training went to work and in less than 3 hours ended up in the hospital emergency room. We have verified with many contract employees that they had to sign a contract in which they agreed never to reveal their hourly wage or talk about their health and must never call 911 if they became ill or involved in an accident. If they do, they will be fired. They are given a company phone number to call instead. The work day is 12 hours or more and can be as long as 21 consecutive days or more, no weekends. One chemical mixer admits to working for as long as 36 hours, staying on the job throughout an entire fracking event. Now, these jobs start at about $15 an hour for the first 40 hours, but with double and triple time, that can come to more than $77,000 a year. But they get no health insurance, and Social Security and income tax are not taken out of their pay. Click. So if you take one of the following contract jobs, you will be exposed to many chemicals that are airborne. The jobs will vary while working on the pad during drilling or fracking. You could be a mudder who mixes the chemicals with the drilling muds, a rigger who helps direct each length of pipe into the preceding length of pipe from way up on the side of the rig. You could end up being a plumber of sorts, fitting and refitting new and old pipe on the drill rigs and shifting and reconnecting pipes from one fitting to another. Here is a man unloading a huge tank to put on a pad. You can see the fittings on the right-hand end where the pipes are coming out. That will be down on the ground. And this could be used to hold the water stripped off the gas as it comes from the ground. And then the trucks back up and take the water out of these tanks as they fill up. Click. Here you see dozens of fracking tanks lined up, ready to take flow back at the end of the frack. A welder is needed constantly throughout both drilling and fracking as pipes are moved from one connection to another. Or you can even end up welding inside a fracking tank. Or if you work for the company that owns the fracking tanks, you could work inside the tank with a steam cleaner and chemicals scrubbing them down. You could also get a job doing what is called workover on the pads of aging or retired wells that are now needing upgrading and brought online, and lots of these have been found leaking across the country. You might also join a large cohort that will move in as the drillers and frackers leave to take over the maintenance and cleaning of the infrastructure they left behind that needs attention 24/7 for the life of the gas field, which could be decades. Click. One of the largest job cohorts exposed to a broad spectrum of chemicals but does not work on the well pad is the drivers of the fleets of the long tubular water trucks. When they pick up recovered wastewater on well pads and haul it to disposal sites, sometimes 100 miles away in another state, they are exposed at both ends as they stand there by the truck's load and while their truck's empty. These laborers are all hired, again, under contract, and again, without access to insurance, and many with gag orders not to discuss their health. Click. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, click. So, I have talked with men after they became too ill to work and have had trouble getting any kind of compensation. They admit from the first week on the job, they experienced a suite of symptoms similar to those that many residents have complained about when drilling starts in their neighborhood, from headaches, burning eyes and skin, coughing, flu-like symptoms, asthma, and insomnia. And they also discover they have hypertension and other systemic problems, which like anyone could experience as he or she ages. But there is no way for clinicians to relate those symptoms with chemical exposure. For many laborers and residents, the nervous system symptoms are the same. So many experiencing peripheral neuropathy, numbness and tingling in their hands and feet, and plagued with totally unpredictable pain, fibromyalgia, and swelling in their arms, feet and legs, and outright multiple chemical sensitivity. Next. It is when the men and women begin to develop tremors, memory loss, and experience convulsions, symptoms of MCS, and deep depression, so that they cannot work anymore and turn to workman's compensation. They find out that they cannot collect because they have nothing to prove they were exposed to something. Whether a resident or a natural gas industry contract worker, they have nowhere to turn to be compensated for their misery and loss of income. That essentially started when the drilling started. Homeowners find themselves in a bind. Too ill to stay where they are. Look at the people living down in this house here to the left. People have no money to move somewhere else to rent because they still have a mortgage on the house that they can't sell. And most of those that I have met are fighting terrible insecurity and depression. Now I know I should do a wrap up now, but I'm way
over. Go ahead, Theo. We really are. What you're giving us is extremely valuable. We don't want to miss it.
Well, okay. Let me move down. What do I have here? It is a tragedy that EPA was told it could not look into air pollution in its upcoming report on fracking. This was a serious omission on the part of the government. And it's true that water contamination poses serious concerns to potable and agricultural water wherever natural gas drilling and reinjection is occurring. But while water contamination is a possibility, you can be sure that air contamination is a certainty. Now, I know that water is of extreme importance to you around the Great Lakes, where you provide water for many people and many purposes. But I want you to know that we, too, in the West, are very concerned about water. Click. Here you see some water trucks lined up along the Colorado River, taking water from the river to haul back to a fracking event. You can see the trucks over on the right in line waiting to get over here to the river to get to the water. Now, click again, because if you shift the camera just a little to the left and look downstream, you will be able to see where one of the trucks had bad brakes and rolled into the Colorado River. It got stuck on something there just downstream from the bridge. That river serves 35 million people downstream. I think I'll stop here, but I do want to give photo credits to Robert Donen from Pennsylvania, Frank Smith from the Western Colorado Congress, and the EPA. And I'll stop here, John.
Okay, thank you, Theo. That's incredibly valuable. If you look at slide 26, you once again seeing the basin that we all live in. What we want to do is give you a quick sense of the state of this issue in each of the jurisdictions around the basin. And we're pleased to have Kim with us here. And if you can do an introduction to begin with the situation in Quebec. And we're at slide 27 now.
Mm-hmm.
Kim?
Hello, everybody. I'm Kim Cornelissen. I'm Vice President of the AQLPA, which is Quebec Association Fighting Air Pollution. Of course, we're really concerned with what Dr. Colburn just said on the air quality, and we're worried about that. Just to give you a bit of what I've been doing, I have a master's degree in urban studies, but my subject was how to develop the biogas market in Sweden with private partnerships. And you have to know that biogas is a natural form of natural gas, and it's an alternative to shale gas, so there was much interest in looking at shale gas. We were sleeping in Quebec for a long time before we realized that there were things happening in Quebec, and this is one of the big problems with everybody is that we had the chance to have access to what Theo's been doing. We had access to some citizens in the States, and it really helped in Quebec to build a case against shale gas. So what I'll be talking to you is what is the geographical distribution in Quebec? What's the position of the government? I'm at slide 28. What is the why we got a BAP, what it is, and also we're getting now a strategic environmental assessment, what that means. But I thought that it was also important to know more about how the citizens are reacting and what's happening in Quebec. If you look at slide 29, this is the big shock we had in 2009 when we realized that all of Quebec that is inhabited, most of where it's inhabited, everything was claimed by gas companies or petrol companies. The map that you see doesn't show if it's gas or petrol, but most of the most of Montrealers, half of the province actually, is living on the lower left side, and that's where the regions where the most shale gas will be in that region, and that's the region that is studied by the government of Quebec. But now we know if you go higher on the map, we know now that they really want to explore there, but since it's petrol, shale petrol, or it's conventional gas, it's like, oh, it doesn't seem to be important. We'll be really dealing only with shale gas and only with three regions, which is a big problem, I think. So click slide 30. The government position from the beginning, it's very clear they're highly favorable towards the industry. What is very obvious also is that they didn't know really that much about shale gas. When the AQLPA met with the government on September 24th, 2009, and we had the impression that we were really telling them what was happening and they didn't know about it. But what we know is that a lot of the public servants from the government went from the government to the industry, and that includes some former ministers. That includes people that were working with Hydro-Québec, for example. So it's very disturbing to see that the expertise that was public that could have been used for Quebec turned into private companies, but that also means that they really know how the government works. The responsibility has been transferred partly from the Ministry of Natural Resources to the Ministry of Environment. And this, in a way, is a good news because we'll be dealing more with environmental issues. And it's clear that since, let's say, August 2010, there's a lot of Quebec, most of Quebec know about shale gas. There's been a very, very good work from the media also to find out everything that was problematic. We had huge help from the U.S. on that subject. Thank you very much on that. And the public pressure was successful enough so that we could get a BAP commission. The BAP is the acronym for the Bureau d'audience publique sur l'environnement, which means hearings on environmental issues. But the interesting thing about the BAP is that it has to be very, very public. It's very important that the population can say what they need to say. And it's usually very effective. The only problem is that they decided that the BAP. Let's go to the slide 31. They decided that the BAP would not be the same length as usual. Usually, it's more than a year. With this one, it was only 4 months. They could not discuss the idea of is it pertinent or not. Should we have shale gas, but only how it could be sustainable. So the idea is, yes, we want shale gas. That's the government saying, yes, we want shale gas, but we want it done in a sustainable way, which for many people in Quebec doesn't make sense, especially citizens. The BAP had a first phase, and the first phase was the experts, and the experts were all either from the industry or from the government. And then in phase two, it was opinions. That means that, for example, if Dr. Colburn had decided to talk at the BAP hearing, she would have had her opinion. So even if you're a scientist or you're anything, you only have an opinion, which is a bit distressing if you think. But the good thing with it is that the BAP said we don't have enough information. We really lack information on a lot of things. And they put the emphasis on water. And I agree with Dr. Colburn that the air is also another a big issue, but there's also quite a lot of issues. Jobs are one also and everything. And they said we should have what you call a strategic environmental assessment. In French, we call that an AAS. Slide 32. And then again, it's the same thing. It's not a typical C, like the OECD is saying. It's more of a truncated one. It's one in which the main committee has the industry in the committee, but they did not allow to have environmental representatives from the environmental movement, and they didn't accept either somebody from the citizen. It is a really clinical view of shale gas. That means that they're very, very far from what's happening on close to the people and everything. It is true that in Quebec we don't have that many wells. We have 31 wells, and 19 of the 31 have problems. And so they've been doing that, saying we will try to do it in a sustainable way again. One of the things that is really that we're really questioning is that a real C should really be about environment first. It's an environmental assessment, but clearly it's an economic. They're looking at the economy. While looking at the economy, they're looking also at the environmental and social issue. But it's clearly not. It's unbalanced. And it's that thing about sustainable development. It should all be social, environmental, and economic should all be on the same side. But actually, it's not. There's really more focus on the economy. The other problem is that all members of the committee aren't close to a well, are not living in rural areas, so there's no danger for them to have a well close to their home. But they all said at the same time, we would not like to have that. But you can understand that all the basic reality and all the basic worries, they don't really have them because they're not in that field. That's why we wanted people that are already implied in the committee, and that doesn't work. The other thing is that it seems that that committee, at first we thought that this was a moratorium or it was a quasi-moratorium. No, it's not. There is no moratorium in Quebec. That means that the companies can still do their work, but the problem is for them is if they want to do their work, they need to ask the committee if that will help them for information. What the citizens' movement and the environmental movement's been saying is that you don't need more information. There are information for years and years already with what's happening in the States, with what's happening with the Utica shale. You absolutely don't need more information. And it looks more for us as if they're doing that just to keep the population quiet rather than really saying we ask for a moratorium. Slide 33. Because there's been two petitions. One petition last year, there was 130,000 people asking for a moratorium. And everybody, it seemed that everybody that were not asking, that did not benefit directly from the shale gas industry, wanted a moratorium. And then after there was a second petition, actually this one was funny in a way, it was asking the Prime Minister to step down because he didn't want a couple of things, and the second thing was that he didn't want a moratorium in Quebec, so there was these people asking for the government, the Prime Minister to step down in Quebec. And then last week we had 20,000 people who signed refusal to access the industry on their property that was sent to the government of Quebec, and this is growing too. This is the only legal way that we can work, which is the industry needs to have people on their, to have the authorization of people to access their land and then to access the underground. You have to understand that in Quebec, the underground doesn't belong to the person, it belongs to to the government, but they still need to have authorization to frack or to go under. And what the industry has been answering was, okay, no problem, we'll ask your neighbor or your second neighbor or your third neighbor and we'll find somebody who will access our property, which is quite distressing. We had also many street manifestation, political demands, and now the farmers are getting in to say we're really worried, we want a moratorium too. And one of the very good things that the citizens been doing is that they went to Pennsylvania to meet with people there, to meet with experts there, and they brought some people, some mayors, some farmers who were saying, I don't think that there's really that much problem, I think people are exaggerating. And when they came back, they were really, really worried about what they saw, and they were really distressed. So they're trying to convince the committee of the sea to go to Pennsylvania and meet the same people that they've met. The other thing is that there's been four, and I'm finishing on that, there's been four public consultation. There was 400 people who went to the consultation. It's the committee of the sea who did that. And out of the 400 person, there was not one comment that was favorable to shale gas. So there is no social acceptability in Quebec. And what people are now beginning to think is that they're thinking about civil disobedience, a pacific one, but very big ones if things don't change, because there is no social acceptability, but the government still goes on and is still on the industry side. So that's mostly what's happening in Quebec. And I put two appendixes just to give you some ideas. I won't be discussing it. I just want for information for you. I've been comparing the BAP on water, the one we had around 2000 that was really everybody appreciated the way it was done. And then after, I put the BAP on shale so you can see the difference on the two. And I did also a small analysis on the difference between what the OECD is saying that a strategic environmental assessment is, and what seems to be the situation in Quebec. So that's it mostly.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Kim. If you can skip ahead now to slide 42, and I'm going to give a very, very brief synopsis of each of the other jurisdictions. And I know that there are many people on the phone call who have much more detail on this, who are working very hard in organizing in each of the other jurisdictions. And one of the reasons that we extended our time till for an extra half hour was to hopefully give some of you a chance to give more detail in terms of what you're doing. But I just want to give a very quick synopsis. If you flip to the slide 42, and that's a picture of Ontario, and the dark green and the light green areas are areas that are black shale. The green area is actually part of the Marcellus shale that we'll be talking about in a minute. But those are potential areas for fracking where the gas is there and it's seen as potential. There is no extraction through fracking at the moment in Ontario, and people in Ontario have been very much asleep on this issue. No formal proposals have been made yet, but, and it's critical to know this, the oil and gas companies have come in and have already leased the rights to shale gas exploration from private landowners to much of the areas that you see, especially the areas in dark green. And that includes the area under Lake Erie. You see the dark green area under Lake Erie? That area has all been, there are private companies that have got the rights to exploration there. So the Environmental Commissioner for Ontario, who's an independent commissioner set up by the provincial parliament, has said to Ontario government that you've got to get on top of this, you have to assess your permitting processes, your criteria, etc., because this will become an issue in Ontario, and they better get ready for it now instead of waiting. Let's go ahead now to slide 44. And this is, of course, the map of the famous Marcellus Shale, and the gray and the green area. And this is seen, if you look at slide 45, this is a quote again from the Canadian Energy Research Institute. This is the lead players in this issue. And they conclude very clearly that they see the Marcellus Shale as one of the economics, if you look at the conclusion, the economics of the Marcellus is very attractive. They see it as one of the prime five areas in the U.S. for this issue. And certainly people living in New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio know that they're following up on that. Industry is very active in the Marcellus Shale. To skip ahead now to the situation in New York State, First of all, if you look back at slide 44, I'm sorry, the map, it looks like this issue of shale and fracking only goes partway up into New York State. The reality is there's something called the Utica Shale, which goes up all the way across the bottom of Lake Ontario and up to the St. Lawrence, which is also an area that's potential for this sort of activity. Back to 48, in New York State, there is currently a moratorium on approvals of new wells since 2008, which has been renewed a few times, and they've been going through hearings on this. And these are basically coming to a conclusion at the moment, and the groups there are working very hard to get this moratorium to be continued. There's the expectation that the government will make a decision sometime this year. The predictions by the state government are that there could be an average of 1,600 applications for each year for a fracking well over a 30-year period. So huge potential here in terms of the issue. Pennsylvania, slide 47, and this is really sort of what people refer to as the old Wild West or the Gold Rush. And people I talked to there described it as a free-for-all, where approvals are happening. The state, since 2008, has approved 6,000 wells into the Marcellus Shale. And as I said, this is seen as the most valuable by industry. And between 2008, over 4,000 wells have actually been drilled. And certainly, people there really do consider that the control efforts by the state are inadequate, that it's just gotten too much for the state to be able to handle at this point, and it really is totally out of hand. Ohio, slide 48. Here in Ohio, again, much of this is the Marcellus Wells, the Marcellus Shale again, so it's a high area in terms of industry interest in doing things here. The estimate is that since the 1950s, approximately 80,000 hydraulic fracturing wells have been installed, and the state is expecting 450 applications each year for the future. Since June 2010, they have had guidelines specific to hydraulic fracturing in place, but there's still a lot of concern about the adequacy of these. If we skip to page 49, one of the big issues that comes out of the whole fracking issue is what you do with the waste disposal when you bring up this water back up. And in New York State, one of the big issues has been the proposals to put this through sewage treatment plants, municipal sewage treatment plants, and the adequacy of that. In Ohio, most of those wastes are being put into deep injection disposal wells, and they're of the class that are not permitted for hazardous waste. They're seen as being for cleaner materials. But these are hazardous materials, and therefore that's clearly a misplacement. Also, there have been 11 earthquakes in the area of a couple of these wells, and there's a real concern that these deep wells and the pushing of these wastes down them is really disrupting the whole system down there. To go on now to Michigan, and we're now talking about a different shale base, the Antrim Shale, which is also seen as a high value, not quite as high as Marcellus, and that's why the activity has been on the Marcellus Shale first. But that most of Michigan is in the Antrim Shale area. If you look at slide 51, the blue items there, this is where wells have already been drilled. And you can see that most of them are up towards the northern part of the southern part of southern Michigan, not the upper peninsula, but in the main part of Michigan. That's where most of the drilling has been happening. And these have been happening for quite a while in the shallow levels, the fairly shallow levels, about 12,000 such gas wells. But the real concern now is that the deep wells are being looked at and starting to be investigated, and those are seen as being much more hazardous and much more potentially disruptive. And thus far, at least two fracturing wells have been drilled in the last couple of years at much deeper levels. And you have to use a lot more significant, larger amounts of fracking fluids in those situations. Indiana and Illinois, and I'm speaking now only within the Great Lakes Basin, I'm at slide 53, I'm speaking only within the Great Lakes Basin. There's little expected activity within the Great Lakes Basin, and that's primarily because of an extension of the Antrim Shale into that area. But thus far, again, within the Great Lakes Basin, this has not been a big issue. Wisconsin and Minnesota, to conclude, is actually a different side of the fracking issue. The preferred formations for shale gas fracking are not present within Wisconsin and Minnesota, but one of the components for doing fracking is in Wisconsin and Minnesota in some of the best frack sands that are critical for the process are actually found in western Wisconsin and southeastern Minnesota. So what we're finding is these are the ideal sands in terms of the size, the shape, their strength, and their purity for fracking. So as a result of the increased fracking activity throughout the United States, we're finding that the pressure on these mines and to do more mining in these areas and the resultant environmental impacts is really growing and likely will grow very dramatically in the next decades. So that's, as I said, a very quick run-through of a précis of the summary in each of the others' jurisdictions. We want to now hear from you in terms of questions, but also information that you would add further or activities that you're carrying out. So I'd like to turn it back to Chris, our telephone operator, to tell people how they can now get involved in this this seminar. Chris?
Thank you. Our first question comes from Luann Azoma. Luann, please go ahead.
Hi there. This is Luann Cosma, sorry. I'm with a new grassroots organization that we formed a couple months ago called Ban Michigan Fracking, and we have a website, banmichiganfracking.org. I've been involved in the fracking issue for over a year now, though, with another group that also seeks a ban called Don't Frack Michigan. I don't know if any of them are on this call. But both of our websites have the actual permits that have been approved by the state of Michigan, and I wanted to clarify that, yes, the Antrim Shale is the shale that's been drilled for many years now, and it's, like you said, John, those shallow wells, but it's the Utica and Collingwood shales that are the much deeper 10,000 feet, whatever, shale deposits that are being sought for the deep horizontal fracking, and those are the ones that we're following on our website. Many of them are on state lands. They're in state forests. We've got miles of pipe being drilled. We've got processing plants in our state forests right now, and we also have some pending applications, about 12, and I understand that about 7 of them just got withdrawn by Chevron this week, and I'm not sure why. So you can take a look at our website, as I said, and see the actual permits. I'm requesting these by Freedom of Information Act request. And we are one of the few groups that are demanding a ban and not a frack study or a frack panel, as is it Kim from Quebec who was saying the frack panel idea is often fraught with insiders to industry and even environmental groups that are really only seeking to regulate and tolerate fracking but not seeking to ban it. And we do have pending legislation that Ban Michigan Fracking is opposed to, a state legislation that would impose a fracking panel and a fracking study funded by the gas industry. And we are opposed to that for the same reasons why everybody's opposed to the New York panel, the New York studies. So thank you for this opportunity to explain.
Well, thank you for your additional information. That's great. Chris, anybody else?
Again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press *1 on your touch-tone phone. Our next question comes from Michelle Bamberger. Michelle, please go
yes.
ahead.
Oh, hi. Myself and my husband, Robert Oswald, we just published a study called The Impacts of Gas Drilling on Human and Animal Health. It just came out in New Solutions. It's in press. So I just wanted to make sure everyone in the group knew that. I also wanted to tell everyone that this is an ongoing study, and the purpose of this study is to look at not only human health but animal health and the two together. Basically, it's a group of case studies, but we also aim to give a lot of information about how policy should go, how research should go, and just sort of summarizing that in general. I do have some questions, which I know there are a lot of other people on this call who also have questions, but what I could do is I'm looking right now at the emails that you guys have provided, and I'd certainly be happy to email
If you want to pose one question now, that would be great.
Okay, great, I will. I'd love to ask Dr. Colborn. This is a question. We have been documenting lots of different species. Probably the biggest group, all told with numbers, has been cattle, mostly beef cattle. We also have some dairy herds. But what we're hearing across the board, and this is across a number of states, we've got about 7 states so far, and we are ongoing, just picked up a few more states that will be in further studies, we hope. But what we're hearing is that there are growth rate problems. The cattle are just not coming up to the poundage they should be by a certain age. Again, that's across the country, not in one specific area. And I'd like to add just a side note to that. I just got an update from a dog breeder. I have several dog breeders we've been documenting too, and have heard in general we've had, including with cattle, stillbirths and congenital malformations. But this was unusual. Last night I just heard from the dog breeder that her litters are smaller. Just usually that she has 10, 11 pups, and she's now having 3 or 4 pups. This is starting to become a regular occurrence. And so I just wanted to pose that question to Dr. Colborn, if she has heard of anything like that in all of her years of documenting health effects of growth problems.
Well, not particularly growth problems, probably because the people that I have been dealing with have small, many of them just had to give up their goats and the few cattle that they had on the place. You know, out here you raise your own beef, that sort
right.
of, you know, it's a domestic, a little small domestic farms. Practically every one of them have gotten rid of their animals. They do have dogs, but each one of them will tell me, well, that dog died last year and this dog died last year. But no real, I know of no one and no veterinarian who is doing this work. We have a veterinarian out here who was trying very hard to become lead an activist organization. She was doing a very fine job, but it became too difficult for her to continue doing that. There are certain pressures that move into communities and areas that most people don't realize. It's fear. It's something that I hope some psychologist or some group will take and look at it. The kind of information you want, yes, is here and there, but it's scattered. And I did read your paper, and I know
thank you.
God bless you that you made it and got it published, but still, it's so difficult to get the information. Most people just want to walk away from it. And I wish I could help you more.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I just want to say just a quick response to that, Theo, is that we have also encountered that fear factor. I will always say to all my cases, How about your neighbors? And they'll say, of course, our neighbors are experiencing this also, but they will not speak to you. They're too afraid. They're too afraid of harassment. They're too afraid the royalty payments will stop. They're too afraid their water will stop being delivered. Their water is bad. They're being supplied with water. If they're lucky, they're afraid that will stop. So we are also encountering that too. But nevertheless, we've managed to come up with enough people who want to document. And I hope that if anyone is listening on this call knows people who want to document, please have them contact me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle. Chris, the next person.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ron Bishop. Ron, please go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to kind of, if I may, qualify something. My name is Ron Bishop. I teach chemistry and biochemistry at the State University of New York at Oneonta, and I'm also a member of Sustainable Otsego here in Otsego County, New York. I've been involved with this issue for about 4 years, and I also want to compliment Michelle and her husband on that wonderful paper. The version that I have had a chance to read was it didn't have the figures with it, but I'll follow up with you on the side on that. I wanted to first of all clarify the fact that New York actually does not and never really did have a moratorium on new gas well development. We've hit the pause button with respect to high volume horizontally drilled hydraulically fractured wells, but traditional wells are still going in at a pretty good clip. We actually have at least 240 new gas wells that have been developed in the last 2 years in Erie County alone. So just to put that out there, it's we have quite a bit of work to do still to get to the bottom of what's going on with that. I'm also just myself finishing an article that I'm hoping to publish in the New York Academy of Sciences Annals, where I look at the history of oil and gas well abandonment in New York using only official state sources. And the upshot of that is that one of the reasons I believe that the oil and gas industry has enjoyed the low costs for a lot of what they've been doing is that they skip a lot of the costs. In this article, I show that in no year since records have been kept have they ever plugged even a majority of the wells that they that go into zero production, that go into final decline. And as a matter of fact, their worst record is actually their most recent record, whereof throughout the 2000s, their plugging rates for the wells that should have been plugged each of these years has run between 4 and 7%. So what I guess I'm trying to ask for is, what can we do, if anything, to connect this obvious failure in terms of post-production cleanup to health effects? Because as you mentioned, it's really difficult to get people to come forward and talk about the health impacts that they're having. And the only health effects I've been able to even show a bubble in our southwestern counties is in a variety of reproductive system and endocrine-type cancers. So what else do you think we could do?
Bill, do you have any thoughts on this?
I'm sitting here listening because I referred to that in one little sentence in my talk. These old wells are all over the place out here, and they're leaking, and they were not plugged correctly, and they're creating real problems. I don't know, but it's something that I will discuss with some of the people who like to work on the ground. I don't know how we even begin to start. It's a whole new approach. It's something else that needs to be addressed. It's like we need a new grassroots organization for every time we find something new. That doesn't seem to be right.
Yeah.
It's wrong. I wish I could help you, Ron, but I can't.
At any rate, I'll send all of you that have your emails here at the end of the talk here. I'll send you drafts of the article, so at least you...
Be very careful. Don't release the draft of the article until you get it published. If the publishers feel that you have distributed this and a lot of people have seen it, they're not going to take it.
Well, what I've done is I've formulated the draft that's being distributed now in the form of comments to the generic environmental impact statement in New York.
Uh-huh.
The article that comes out is going to be more of a pure scientific article.
Okay.
So I'm hoping to, you know, weasel a little bit that way.
Okay.
Ron, it's Kim. Just a detail, in Quebec, and I don't know what the legislation is in New York, but in Quebec, if you plug the well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that it belongs then to the it's back to the government to take care of it. And one of the scientists, and I could put you in charge with him, a geologist, said that a lot of problems when the well is plugged, there can be still a lot of problems on the ground and everything, and then it's the government who would have to pay for all the problems for it. So there are some legal issues on that, at least in Quebec. I could put you in contact with the researcher who's working on that.
Actually, I may already have that paper. I cited it in this article.
Okay, Ron, we need to move along. Thank you for the clarification on the extent of the moratorium, and so I appreciate that. Okay, next questioner or commenter.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rita Yelda. Rita, please go ahead.
Hi, sorry. Okay. My name is Rita. I actually, right now, I'm living in Buffalo, New York. And my question is to CEO Colburn. I've been going through a lot of your materials, and it's been really helpful for me as far as what's in fracking fluid, and the effects of exposure to fracking fluid. As right now, I'm kind of working on this issue. Niagara Falls is the first location in New York State to say that they would like to treat fracking wastewater. This is obviously a huge issue because they release into the Niagara River, which goes into Lake Ontario, and that's all of Toronto's water supply. So it would affect all Great Lakes communities, really. So I guess my question to you is there any research out there about the treatment of fracking fluid, or can you, recommend, like, the next step? I mean, this is obviously something that we don't want them to do there. We've been trying to tell them, you know, it's very hard for even the industry to know what's in their fracking waste because they're not provided with specifics. They're provided with these really vague MSDS sheets. And so a lot of it is really like self-reporting and the industry expecting themselves to come forth with all of the chemicals that have been in the waste. So I would just like to get Dr. Colburn's input on what she thinks the potential impacts this could have to the Great Lakes, and then also an area where she thinks might be helpful for me to find some more information about fracking waste.
Well, I can understand why a city that sits on so much water going through there, they should come out here and look at the Colorado River.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of water there. But to me, this is our life support system. You don't fool around with our life support system by trying to take that and assimilate what they're putting into the ground to drill and frack with and take your chances. As far as I'm concerned, I think it's a very poor idea. And I hope no municipality gets involved in doing this. I wish I could be more helpful. No, every now and then I'll read about it. You just have to watch the daily news every day because there's something in the news every day about fracking the natural gas now. And there is a wonderful news service called Above the Fold. And you can go to, if I remember right, Environmental Health. Help me, somebody. Pearl, are you on the line? I was hoping one of my staff could get in on the line here. Environmental Health News, that's what it is. Go to Environmental Health News, and then if you go down to the bottom of their sheet there, they have a thing called Above the Fold. And every day they have they're searching every bit of the news that's coming out about toxics and health, and, of course, natural gas development is one of these things that they're looking at. And you can pick up and begin to find cohorts, or I would say not cohorts, but people who share your same concerns around the country by just getting in and looking at that. And you can go back. They archive everything. So you can go back and look through their archived stories about treatment of fracking fluid. That would be the the search terms you would use. I'm sure you know how to get in and do some good searching. But if you get into above the fold and then get that every day, I get it every morning at 8 o'clock, it keeps us very current. And that's what you all need to be using so that you can see what somebody else is doing around the country and maybe unite more in your efforts.
To your knowledge, has there been any long-term impact study on releasing like treated fracking wastewater effluent into public water sources? Has there been anything like that to date?
Well, we had whether it was the disposable water, I'm not quite sure what happened, but I know we have some rural communities here that soon didn't know that the stuff was being trucked and dumped into their sewage treatment system until their sewage treatment broke down. Of course, that was stopped immediately. But I know of nowhere, just off the top of my head, that I can help you with on that.
Okay, thank you, Rita. Chris, anybody else?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Emma Louie. Emma, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say thanks to Great Lakes United for organizing this call and for all the experts for their great information. I was actually going to raise the Niagara Falls, the treatment of fracking wastewater as well, and I've worked with Rita on this, but I can just ask another question related to your presentation, John, about land leases in Ontario. And I wondered if there's a place where we can find information on who's leasing the land. And like I know Mooncore, one company, but I wondered if there's any particular spot where we can
get there it. Is. If you, I haven't got it off the top of my head, but if you email me and you have my email address there,
yeah.
I can send you a website from an activist great. Group that has that.
Okay, excellent. I'll do that for sure.
Okay, thank you, Emma.
Thanks.
Okay, anybody else? Chris.
Our next question comes from Ted Turner. Ted, please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks very much for this. I am in Toronto, so my ears perked up when I heard about the Niagara River situation. My question has partly been answered, but I'm going to expand on it. Are there any long-term epidemiological studies, you know, health studies on the effects of these fluids on workers, ex-workers, and residents? And if not, why not?
I would say for the same reason that people are fearful. What we are discovering now is that people are afraid to talk because they have to drive down the same narrow roads that those company trucks are being driven on. Their neighbor next door may be very happy about having royalties and that sort of thing. So you've got the fear factor. But the other big thing is now that when people complain, we now have, especially out here, several national law firms that have been involved in class action suits that are actually absorbing these people and helping these people get settlements, which once they settle, we've lost them. It's just like the Love Canal thing. Love Canal, a lot of people were paid to move away, but they would never talk again. Gag orders. And it's the gag order situation now that we're in with so many of these people. And you can't blame them. You have to come out here and just maybe spend just a few days, and you'll begin to feel the fear in the air. It's here. So that is probably one of the biggest things. You know, we still don't have a really good epidemiological study that's done on Love Canal for the same purpose. Wherever you're dealing with major corporations that have control over vast areas of land and also control over the people that are living there, and believe me, they have power, people are not going to become a part of it. There was one study done by someone from the Colorado Colorado University, and in cooperation with Garfield County, and it was an HIA, and it is amazing what information they were able to pull out of that. You need to, it's health information assessment, you need to get into that. I'm sure you can pick it up if you start Googling. and read that whole study, look at what they discovered, and the information is being ignored. Oh, there's something in there that definitely showed that in this area where natural gas is taking place, more babies are born with serious birth problems. But no one has paid any attention to it. No one's moving on with it. So you might look to that. But that study had a lot of problems, and now they're back trying to redesign the study and maybe do another one. That one, I believe, is being done in cooperation with the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission in Colorado, and possibly the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, which is the association, of course, of industry. So start looking for that. I wish I could help you more, but I can't pull it up.
That's very scary, isn't it?
Well, it is very scary. This has been a problem for a long time.
Okay, thank you, Ted. Anyone else?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Charlie Tarr. Charlie, please go ahead. Charlie, your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Thank you. I had the phone muted. I wanted to ask specifically if anyone is aware of concise information relating the volumes of consumption in steam-assisted gravity drainage mining, as I understand it to have been introduced in Fort McMurray for the Athabasca tar sands, principally by British Petroleum, under the reign of Tony Hayward in approximately February of 2010. Several of my Canadian colleagues have spoken of stunning volumes of gas being consumed, and that there is likely a direct correlation between the gas being consumed for SAGD mining of the tar sands and the concise interest in the Marcellus and Utica in our area of southern Ontario and New York State. But I wanted to ask if anyone has looked more concisely in those toward those data relationships.
Kim, Theo, I certainly haven't.
No.
No.
Okay. If anyone else has that's on the call, please be sure and then push asterisk one, and let us know.
Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. Sorry, were you going to say something?
Yes. Well, there is a group, and I'll have to dig it up and maybe try to find it for you, that has been looking at the energy in to get energy out, and the energy in seems to be exceeding the energy out that we're getting from so many of these processes. And I would expect I can find that the name of that organization for you. They're pretty powerful, and I think they're right in New York City. You might be able to get some information there, but they've been fighting from that perspective from the beginning.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
You burn so much diesel. When you think of all the diesel that's being burned, that sort of thing, and then the gas that's lost, there probably is a negative gain there.
Okay, thank you, Charlie. Anybody else?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sarah Miller. Sarah, please go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is an observation of another issue that may be under the radar in the Great Lakes, but should be pursued, and it has to do with ecosystem health from adequate water quantity. And it strikes me that a lot of the wastewater from these operations are being moved from one watershed to another, but not being captured by any of our water management regimes here, but could, in fact, amount to virtual diversions from the Great Lakes or between watersheds in the Great Lakes. And it's something I think that merits more study by groups like Great Lakes United.
Thank you for the suggestion, Sarah. Any comments from anyone else on that? Okay, thank you, Sarah, for the suggestion.
Well, may I just throw in one thing,
yep.
John? I've always wondered, and I wish someone would do it, so much of this water now that they've taken from the surface, mm-hmm. To pull out of our rivers and streams, to frack with, and then they bring it back up, but then we re-inject this way down way down 10,000, 12,000 feet below the ground, we're actually pulling that water out of the hydrological cycle.
Right.
And I don't, you know, industry will argue, well, that's nothing. It's so small. What we're doing is just, you know, you'll never miss it. But I just wonder how true that is, and I think we need to look into that. Again, it's our health support system, our life support system that's disappearing. It's being reduced. And we know, I mean, from the time, you know, I went back to college and began studying about water, there's only a limited amount of potable water on the surface of the earth. It's a very small amount. The rest of it is all salt water. And we can't keep producing energy to convert salt water to drinkable water. We're going to run out. There's just something wrong here with this whole process.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else, Chris?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jim. Jim?
Sorry, Sorry, who was it, Chris?
Jim Olson.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Chris. And thank you, John, panelists. Very informative. I have just a general comment. I'm an attorney from, environmental water attorney from Michigan. And litigated the Nestle case, and some of you may know, and active in water issues, but also fracking, and have started an organization called Flow for Water, and I'm chair of that. And one of the things we're looking at is a more comprehensive legal analysis of all the issues with fracking, so this is a very helpful meeting. And Dr. Colburn, frankly, I'm aware of air issues. I've had a couple of cases over the years involving shutting down H2S wells.
Oh, good.
Because of a nuisance impact under common law. The question I have is really quite basic, but could you give us a description of what you would consider to be scientifically the minimum scientific requirement for reliable air monitoring at someone's residence and or near a location of one of these typical frack wells that you've looked at,
What it might cost?
Well, not only what it might cost, what do you think is required minimally? What kind of monitoring and parameters?
I wish I was in my office. Maybe I can pull it up. You would have to first, and this is just for air, you would have to set up a continuous monitoring program with ozone and nitrogen oxides. And that has to be, to be and stand up in court and beat, you know, the Clean Air Act, or meet the Clean Air Act requirements, that's a 24-hour day, round-the-clock system that you'd have to monitor for. Now, if you look at my DVD, I didn't even talk about ozone today, but ozone is another problem that is generated on these pads, but it's also something that moves up into the air and in the daylight and the sunshine with the hydrogen, the diesel fuel with the nitrogen oxides and all the VOCs that are present, you produce ozone. So you would have to set up an ozone monitor. You'd have to check the NOx. That alone would cost, I would expect, many million dollars a year because you have to have all the electrical equipment. And then you would have to start doing around-the-clock continuous monitoring for a whole suite of chemicals, which right now I think are costing about $2,000 a hit. That's just for a daily testing to determine what is there. It's going to be very costly. No one individual could possibly afford to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be done strategically in areas where a company comes in, they buy up all the leases, they know they're going to have their tract, their section on that piece of land. Well designed, it could be stuck right in the middle of where this gas patch is going to go. But no one's going to pay for it.
Right.
EPA does not have the money. They would love to. I know in Colorado decided they had to do something about ozone. I mean, we were hitting ozone, you know, in ski areas out here, like in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, 155 parts per million, out here by Aspen, just below Aspen, about 115. And, you know, that's well above the 75 or 90 that is present.
Sure.
Where we know at 40, anything 40 is going to make you sick. So it's a big issue. Now I lost my train of thought. What was I going to say next? I guess the EPA people that I have talked to would love to be able to do this. And this is what's made it so difficult for them to enforce. You can't enforce if you can't demonstrate exposure. Now, so many of the chemicals, again, that we're talking about don't build up in the blood. They're not in the urine. They're not in the tissue. They're volatile. So you can't even go and take a sample from this person and get a sample that could possibly make the link.
One of the things you mentioned, the epidemiological studies, and the question was asked about that. Are there secondary studies, peer-reviewed studies that can be looked at for some of the key compounds and chemicals that are at risk, such as the VOCs? Because I know when you don't have a direct study, you can go and study, you know, the benzene exposures of rubber workers in the 1920s, or there's so many varieties. Has anybody put a secondary list together that would perhaps create a threshold proof to the agencies that might require them to shift the burden of proof before they approve permits under various state duties? Because some states, Michigan and certainly Ohio, have some kind of EIS responsibilities in which that could be raised, thus testing the institutional framework a little bit.
The only way we've been able to do it and approach it from anything is you can look at our work. We go through and we take the name of the chemical, and we try to use the CAS number if we can, the chemical
right.
number. But and then we do the literature search. We may hit on so many of these chemicals, because many of them are common, we may hit 15,000 hits. I have one of the best search machines I think have going here, looking into the commercial literature, the federal government papers, and that sort of thing. Then you have to go through that, and you can pull out a few. For hydrogen sulfide, I have just found two beautiful studies that definitely says hydrogen sulfide blows the brain. Believe me, it's there. Excellent studies. But that's very rare, and that's very unusual. In most cases, there isn't even a standard set for some of these things that I was talking about. No standard set. And we can find no health effect studies on some of them, because they're chemicals that nobody produced. They've just come up from the ground naturally. Nobody's wanted them. But a lot of the ones that the native chemicals that have come up out of the ground, industry has captured. And that's what they make into solvents. They're using these dangerous chemicals to make solvents and other chemicals and products. And they've very carefully done that. That's how they get rid of some of their waste. So I'd love to talk to you sometime. Call me. We could go on here for hours.
I could hear that.
I'm going to have to interrupt now. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to interrupt. We only have 4 minutes left. I'd like to get one more question in. So thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Chris?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Laura Malloy. Laura, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Laura Malloy. I'm a professor of biology at Hartwick College in Oneonta, New York, so we're right above the Marcellus and Utica Shale. And I have questions to direct to Dr. Colburn and also Dr. Bamberger, if she's still in the audience. And this is a good carry-on from the previous question. What I would like to know is whether or not there's any identification specifically of elements of hydraulic fracturing fluids that have been identified as teratogens. I know that in Dr. Bamberger's study, she talked about problematic reproductive effects, including birth defects, and I was wondering if there was any more specific information on that, either references that I might be able to access or other kinds of information I might be able to get about teratogenic effects. And the other thing was, I apologize, Dr. Colburn, I missed the first few slides of the presentation, and I don't know if you specifically talked about cardiovascular health effects. So I have a question about that as well.
Cardiovascular is one of the common things that perch up. The first thing is probably hypertension, or people begin to fibrillate, that sort of thing. But the doctor has no idea. You know, people have these kind of things happen, so there's no way that the doctors can make the link. Now, you need to go to my website, and it's monstrous. You can get in, and you can pull up And if you go to the website, we will list, we list all those 900 and some products. Then in another column called chemicals, if you know how to use an Excel spreadsheet, you can click on chemicals. On every, for every one of those chemicals, we have made a list of their health effects. We've given the columns, and you can get in, and you can actually dig, and we are providing the citations. The citation is there for the reason why we put in an X in the box, because this thing caused, well, teratogens. Teratogens is not one specifically we looked at, but if you look at developmental reproductive, you'll get that. You can go into that. But you can start going through and looking at each of the health effects. We have the citations. The papers are there. You can go get them. If you can't get them, we'll gladly PDF them to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'm going to have to cut this off. I realize there are other people that have questions. If you look on the second last page of the package we sent you yesterday, page 56, you find the email addresses for all three of our speakers, and I've been assured by our speakers that they would be pleased to receive an email from you if you have any question to be able to respond to you. But we simply, you know, have to finish up now, and I apologize for that. We've been really excited in pulling this together, and it's one of a series that we're doing of seminars just to get people talking about the issues with each other. And it's been really valuable. This one, as I said, we had to cut off the booking at 200 because that's the amount the system can handle, and it shows how, you know, engaged people are in this issue and how concerned and active people are on it. And been very pleased with the people who have commented in terms of their activities that they're doing. I want to really thank our speakers, Theo, Kim. You've been wonderful. Have brought us extremely important information. And Lauren, who's our staff person at Great Lakes United, has spent a huge amount of time pulling together this list of people who are getting the information out to all of you who are on the line, which is a huge task. We really appreciate it. And also Chris for his work through the phone company in terms of handling this system. Again, we thank all of you for this. We're doing this as a series of seminars. If people have thoughts in terms of, you know, are there things perhaps that people should be doing together around the Great Lakes Basin or whatever, if you wanted to send me any emails with those thoughts on it, we have not made specific plans in terms of follow-up. These are seen by us as educational sessions and the opportunity for people to get to know each other a bit better. But if you have thoughts in terms of a follow-up or whatever, please don't hesitate to send those ideas to me, and you have my email address. So again, thanks to all of you, and we have another session planned. I think this was the next one will be on the current situation in terms of the lamprey in the Great Lakes and new methods that are being looked at to keep the lamprey under control, and that will be noticed on our website. Okay, thanks to all of you. Bye-bye.
Hi.
That concludes today's teleconference. Please disconnect your lines.